Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 276, recorded Monday, December 5th, 2016, IARPA. Triangulation is brought to you by Automatic, the small adapter that turns your clunker into a smarter, connected car. For more information on their brand new Automatic Pro adapter, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the limited time offer code TWIT20 for $20 off the new device. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/triangulation. And by Optical Cables by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and talk about the world around us, what's to come, sometimes even the past. I'm glad you're here today because we have a very special guest, and I have to acknowledge a longtime friend, a regular host on this network, Mark Pelletier, for helping us out with this one. Hello, Mark.
Hey, Leo. How are you?
Mark, 10 years ago, started Futures in Biotech on this network. Occasionally still does shows, futuresinbiotech.com, but he's gotten a little busy because he is the founder and CEO of Aromics, which he founded at the Yale School of Medicine while he was there. And they are working on creating new drugs for the treatment of cerebral edema. And they're currently getting close to human trials. So that's pretty exciting, Mark. And that's kept you busy, I understand.
Quite busy. We're trying to control the physiology of water. So, and you can imagine your brain is 80% water. So, if we could control it, we could potentially have a major advance in stroke, which is the second largest cause of death. And that's our goal, is to do that. But, today we're going to interview, Dr. Jason Matheny, who has an entirely, different mission, but really on the cutting edge. And, he's really pushing the frontier of computational science and in a way that just goes well beyond anything I could actually explain. He's the director of IARPA, and perhaps we could have him explain to us what IARPA is and then their mission, and then I'd love to go into how he got into the process of leading some of the greatest research in IT.
Jason, welcome to Triangulation. Great to have you. I should explain first that Jason's on the phone because, good news, IARPA does not have an ungated connection to the internet because it's a, you know, Jason, is it fair to call it the moonshots for the intelligence community?
That is fair to say. Yeah, we go after the high risk, high payoff research projects that that focus on national intelligence problems. So everything from how do you develop the next generation of high-performance computers to next generation machine learning, next generation neuroscience. We fund a broad variety of research.
We should say Dr. Matheny has the credentials to do this as well, a PhD in applied economics from Johns Hopkins, a master's in public health from Johns Hopkins, an MBA from Duke, a BA from the University of Chicago, founder of two biotech companies, worked at the World Bank, at Oxford University, at the Applied Physics Laboratory and the Center for Biosecurity. Wow. I'm very impressed. But you know what was most interesting to me is your article in October from October 2007, Reducing the Risk of Human Extinction.
Yeah, that's right. One of the topics in risk analysis that's of great interest to a large part of the research community is how do we tackle these low probability, high consequence events? So I decided to focus on what is the lowest probability, highest consequence events that we could use as a model case. And that one looked at the probability of asteroid impacts and applying traditional cost-benefit analysis to an untraditional problem.
So that combined both public health, because it was part of your public health work at JHU, but also that's kind of economics in a way. How did you come to work in the intelligence community, though? That's very different than the academic community.
Yeah, so when I was working in global health about a decade ago, I was working in India on a public health effort, and a lot of the folks that I had worked with were part of the smallpox eradication campaign, which in the 60s and 70s successfully eradicated a disease that we no longer have to suffer from. So it killed about 100 million people in the last century, and thanks to its eradication, it's prevented about 150 million deaths. So we're all very grateful to the smallpox eradication efforts of the World Health Organization and others. But while I was there in India, for the first time, a virus was created from scratch.
Yikes.
And that technology, which is now part of what we call synthetic biology, was really only just germinating then in 2003 when that milestone was reached. And I think, you know, while one part of the scientific community was really excited about what this meant in terms of the new tools that we could use for biomedicine, biomaterials, agriculture, energy, being able to really engineer organisms to do useful work, another part of the bioscience community was worried about what this might mean, for instance, in being able to recreate smallpox or something worse. And the folks who I worked with were really part of the latter camp. You know, they were the worry warts. And I then moved from working on traditional global health to working on these lower probability but possibly higher consequence outbreaks of engineered pandemics. As I got along further into that work, you know, looking at what were sort of the worst cases in disease and how might we mitigate those risks, how might we be able to address a pandemic that was engineered, I found that many of the problems that I was working on really came down to a problem of national intelligence. How can we gain earlier insight into the actors who might want to, for instance, engineer an organism, create a biological weapon, or accidentally release a biological weapon? And what could we do in national intelligence in order to detect disease outbreaks sooner? So that's why I came into the community and since then have worked on a large number of problems. Some of them are related to epidemiology. Some of them are related more generally to data science and machine learning. What's really exciting, I think, about national intelligence is you have lots of problems that relate directly to global security, including global health, but also global economic stability, the resilience of our networks in cybersecurity. How do we gain earlier insight into what's happening in the world so that we can reduce threats before they break out?
Yeah, I see this in business with something called BI, business intelligence. Because of big data and the analytics we suddenly can do, any well-run business is now starting to look at existing data and try to use that to plot the future. That's a kind of a low-risk analysis. You're doing this. It sounds like you're doing the same thing in things that could be highly dangerous to us, not just as a country, but globally. The thought of biowarfare is terrifying. So I'm looking, I mean, we should. I don't think we've said what IARPA stands for. It's the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. It sounds like it's not a coincidence that it sounds like DARPA. Or ARPA, but
that's
you're
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we work very closely with DARPA, and we have a similar business model, which is we don't do any research in-house. We instead contract out the research projects to the best and brightest we can find in academia and industry around the world to work on our hardest problems. So if you come to our offices at IARPA in College Park, Maryland, instead of seeing, you know, a laboratory with shoe phones and jetpacks and supercomputers and robots, instead you'll see lots of smart scientists and engineers who are writing research contracts and research grants to scientists and engineers elsewhere in colleges and universities, startups. And the advantage of that is that we don't depend only on our own workforce. There's a law ascribed to Bill Joy which is most of the smartest people work for somebody else.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty key to our mission, is knowing that most of the smartest people work for someone else. How can we work with them on some of our toughest problems?
According to your website, you focus on four different research areas. Analysis to get, you know, we know, for instance, the NSA is collecting huge bunches of data, but that data by itself is completely useless. In fact, could overwhelm with too much information. So how to maximize insight from the information that we have. And I love this category, anticipatory intelligence, to develop technologies that can give decision makers timely and accurate forecasts about national security, collection to improve the value of data collected, and then operations, which is the kind of the most, you know, kind of similar to what we'd expect from a spy agency, endeavors to counter new capabilities implemented by our adversaries that could threaten our ability to operate freely and effectively in a networked world. In other words, to fight cyber warfare.
Yeah, that's one of the areas in which we work is in cybersecurity. We do a lot of work in advanced computing, like quantum computing, for instance. We're the world's largest investor in academic research in quantum computing, as well as superconducting classical computing. We're a big investor in neuromorphic computing, a big investor in machine learning applied to imagery, video, human language, so new developments in machine translation and automated speech recognition. And then that category that you mentioned in anticipatory intelligence, we run forecasting tournaments in which teams forecast real events before they happen, and we keep score. So the advantage of this is that a lot of data science research, a lot of research in statistics and machine learning, is done retrospectively. Effectively, what researchers do is try to predict history. And that turns out to be a relatively easy problem to solve, because we already know how history turned out. Yeah. And you're sort of fitting data backwards to a model to see how closely it fits observations. It's much harder to test your models by predicting things that haven't happened yet. And yet that's probably the gold standard for testing a theory about how the world works. So we conduct forecasting tournaments in which hundreds of researchers will compete against one another to forecast the outcomes of foreign elections, or whether or not a treaty will get signed, or whether or not a weapon will get tested, whether or not a particular disease outbreak will occur, whether or not a cyber attack will occur. So by doing all that kind of forecasting of real events and keeping score, we get a much better sense of what kinds of events we can forecast and what kinds of events might be unforecastable, that truly left to the error term in some model of the world. That lets us know then where can we remain confident in our assessments, and where should we remain humble.
We'll have more with Dr. Matheny and IARPA. Their tagline is "Be the Future." I love this stuff. But first, I'm going to talk a little bit about my quantified self, or my quantified car, to be more accurate. It's Automatic, the adapter that goes right on your OBD2 port and lets you know exactly what's happening with your car. They've just launched, we've talked about Automatic before, right? Everybody has an OBD2 port, every car since 1996. This plugs right in. It's not a difficult thing to do. You just pop it right on there. It uses the power from the car without draining your battery, because it's smart enough to turn itself off when you're not going anywhere. But this is the cool thing. It's got a Bluetooth transmitter, so it pairs to your phone. And this is the new Automatic Pro, which has a full-time 3G connection that gives you information about your car even when your phone is not present. So I use the Automatic to know where my car is parked, for instance, anytime. You could track your vehicle when you're not with it. This is if you've got teenagers driving your car. You can put the Automatic in. They don't have to add it to their phone. You can see what's going on. You can have geofencing, get alerts when they go out of a certain area. You know, our teenager, you know, we're not going to let him drive on the highway for the first year, obviously. I think even in California, I think the law prohibits it. So this way we'll know. We'll see when he gets, if he breaks that rule. It works with if this, then that, so you can customize this even more. You can, for instance, keep track of business mileage with Concur or Expensify or FreshBooks. You can link your car to your Nest thermostat. So when you get home, the heat, or you're on your way home, the heat turns on, or your Amazon Echo. So you can actually say you can ask the Echo, where did I park my car? And it'll tell you. Or how much gas is in the tank? It'll tell you. Importantly for you and for your teenager, it also, Automatic Pro will detect severe accidents and call for trained responders, even if you can't. Now, this is really, really good. Automatic works on nearly every car made after 96. It takes just minutes to connect your car to an iPhone or an Android via Bluetooth. It works with the Apple Watch. I love getting automatic information on my Apple Watch. With your Pebble Watch. The Hue lights, the Echo. I mean, this, I can go on and on. I had it set up so that whenever I arrived at the studio, it would tweet. I turned that off. That turned out to be kind of annoying. Plus, it warned the staff I was here. couldn't surprise them anymore. But I also have it send an a note about the trip, every trip I take to Evernote, so I can get a map of the trip, how much gas I used, how good a driver I was, whether I over-accelerated or over-braked, that kind of thing. It's really, really fantastic. Automatic Pro, this is the new one, normally $129.95, but we've got an offer code, of course, TWIT20 to save you $20. Visit automatic.com/twit, read up on it, and use the offer. When you decide to buy, use your offer code TWIT20 to save $20 off the regular purchase price. If you don't want the 3G, by the way, there's no 3G subscription fee. That it just includes the 3G for that price. If you don't want the 3G, they have the original Automatic as well. Automatic, but we don't have the $20 off that one. We want you to get the Pro. Automatic.com/twit, $20 off the Automatic Pro with the offer code TWIT20. This thing is really cool. It's all about information, isn't it? In fact, that's what IARPA is all about. And science. Our guest is the director of IARPA, which is a part of the National Intelligence Community. The Internet, what does IARPA stand for? The Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. Jason Matheny is our guest.
I'd like to know a little bit about the structure of the organization, in that, do you fund research that stays private, or does this research, because the universities that are being funded, or it's getting funded through the various universities and collaborators and companies, I guess the company work is fairly confidential and so forth, but are you looking for commercialization path of these technologies, then say the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has access to the technology to use and make important assessments, or how do you balance the confidential and non-confidential? Is most of this going to translate out eventually to the general population?
Yeah, most of what we fund is unclassified, and most of what we fund remains the intellectual property of the person who invented it, or the company that invented it, or the university that invented it. So that has a number of advantages. By keeping it unclassified, a much broader pool of scientists and engineers can work on our problem, and it can be tested under peer review, which is really useful in order to build on past results, test them against contemporary results, and have future researchers be able to build on both the positive and negative findings from our own research. Having the inventors retain their IP has a number of other advantages in that they can commercialize what they produce for IARPA. And by having commercial markets for some of these technologies, the technologies are better. It's better when there are a large number of customers who have different technology needs. It's going to be able to spread the cost of that technology over a larger number of customers. And typically then the technology is also stronger as a result. So we like to see the technologies commercialized when it's practical. And we've had technologies that have been commercialized. One example that comes to mind is a technology that we funded on facial recognition which came out of a small spinoff from Carnegie Mellon called PitPat, and then was purchased by Google. And as it underlies a lot of the facial recognition in Google searches, but also is a tool that's used throughout government.
You're doing such interesting stuff, you know. And well, for instance, I'm looking at the challenge pages. How do you know if you can trust someone? Is there a way to measure something, some metric, their facial features? I don't know, where you could say, this is a trustworthy person. What a fascinating topic. And I could see the import for the security community, obviously, and diplomats. Does some of this stuff get classified afterwards? I would imagine some of it has to.
So that project in particular, which was the Instinct Challenge, it was unclassified. It was conducted out in the open. And one of the great things about that challenge is that a small group of hobbyists really ended up doing a better job
in doing the
data analysis than a large defense contractor that was also competing in that challenge.
They were called Jedi Mind.
That's right. So it sort of demonstrates the value of putting some of these challenges out into the open and leaving it for anyone who wants to participate to compete. But, you know, that is an important challenge in the national security community. It's figuring out who to trust with information, who to trust with access. But it's also a problem for the commercial sector. Intellectual property and trade secrets are something that are really valuable. It's something that a lot of companies now want to make sure that they understand what are the security risks. So we have a new program that's called SITE, Scientific Advances to Continuous Insider Threat Evaluation, in which many of the research teams are made up of industry leaders who are concerned about insider threats because of trade secrets or intellectual property. So, for example, GE is General Electric is one of the teams that's competing because it has a lot of experience with a large workforce that has access to a lot of IP.
But at the same time, I don't want to sanitize what you're doing because ultimately it's under the Director of National Intelligence. This really is research, blue sky, moonshot research, but research I'm sure that's funded ultimately to help us in our national security.
That's correct. Yeah, that we don't try to duplicate what the National Science Foundation is doing, or what the National Institutes of Health are doing, which is research in their case that's really meant to serve a variety of non-intelligence missions. Our goal is to serve national intelligence. It turns out that many of these technologies also have other applications,
sure,
which is great, and we're deeply gratified. But we will not start a research project unless we understand that it's going to serve a national intelligence priority. So that is one way in which we're distinguished from other federal funders of research.
So who initiates this? Does the Office of the Director of National Intelligence come to you and say, we'd like to know something? Are you kind of blue skying here? Where do your projects come from?
They come from program managers. Who are scientists and engineers themselves who work at IARPA for a short time. No one works as a program manager here for more than 5 years, most of them even less than that. And they typically have been working for many years themselves in solving a particular problem and realized at some point that they might be able to solve that problem if they could get 100 of the best scientists and engineers from around the world to work on their problem. So they come here in order to have a multiplier effect. Some of them come from academia. Some of them come from other government labs. Some of them come from industry. And what's really unusual about IARPA and DARPA is that the program managers within those organizations have a great degree of freedom in picking what the research problem is, identifying the researchers through a competitive process that can allow the best teams to be funded, and then running multiple teams in parallel such that that you can see which is the winning approach. we spend about a quarter of our program budgets on testing and evaluation. That's a lot of money that we spend in order to figure out who's doing better on a particular task, which technology is really achieving the goals. So we don't start a program unless we have a program manager who has a vision, and a vision that doesn't break the laws of physics. We have a priority for national intelligence.
Wait a minute, NASA's glad to investigate stuff that break the laws of physics, right? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, the M drive.
Yeah, the M drive. Yeah,
that's, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So we have some things where the engineering of how to build you know, for instance, an ion trap based quantum computer, that's a really hard problem. We know that it doesn't break the law of physics to actually build such a computer. So one of the challenges that the program managers have is how do you measure success? And how do you make sure that that research stays on track and ensure that you're making the right investments? And the program managers here really do have, I think, one of the best jobs in government, in that they get to take on extremely high-risk problems. Problems that maybe from the start you would say there's less than a 50% probability in succeeding. But they get the resources that they need to either succeed or to have an extremely instructive failure. That is, one whose negative results will be highly informative and one that allows us to advance science.
I think this program manager model is really innovative and unique. I mean, this is a short-term, 3 to 5 year job. You come to IARPA with an idea, and I think it's a great way to kind of seed your IARPA with some really exciting and, as you say, high risk, high reward research.
Yeah, I agree. I think the term limits are part of what makes this work. First, we always have new program managers who have new ideas. They come in with lots of energy. They know that they have a short term, so they don't waste any time. And they themselves are world-class scientists and engineers who recognize strong ideas and weak ideas, which is equally important. So they know who the relevant researchers are. They're willing to take a portfolio approach in the research that they fund. In order to ensure that we have a diversity of technical approaches that are explored. I really do think this is one of the best gigs in government.
Sorry, guys, I don't want to slow this down, but we're having a great conversation with Dr. Jason Matheny, director of IARPA. We'll get back to that in just a second, but I've time to take a break for one of our sponsors, the fabulous folks at Quicken Loans, who have invented a product just for you geeks, we geeks, called Rocket Mortgage. Last time we bought a house, about 3 years ago, it wasn't even that long ago, it was a long, drawn-out process that involved a lot of financial paperwork and records and schlepping it to the loan office and the loan officer going, well, let me see, and going through pieces of paper. I think I have a product right for you. In fact, it literally took 6 or 7 weeks. It was crazy. And Lisa and I said, never again. So let me tell you, the next time we buy a house or we refi, we're going to Rocket Mortgage, quickenloans.com/triangulation. First of all, no paper. You don't have to go through stacks of old files of paperwork. You can submit bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button, answer a few easy questions. You'll get approved, not in 6 weeks, in minutes, for a custom mortgage solution tailored to your unique financial situation. They call it push button get mortgage. And, you know, it comes from Quicken Loans, one of the foremost mortgage lenders in the country. They're nationwide equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS consumeraccess.org number 3030. They will really, I mean, it's really, if you watch the process on this, on the video on the website, you see how straightforward it is. So whether you're, you know, looking at an open house and you want to get a loan right then and there, or maybe you want to refi, or maybe you just want to pre-qualify for a loan before you go house hunting. You can do it all from the comfort of your couch, on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer with Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage. Go to quickenloans.com/triangulation. And maybe you're not looking for a house today, but keep that in mind, would you? Put a post-it note next to the phone or something so you remember. quickenloans.com/triangulation. We thank Rocket Mortgage for making triangulation possible. And I'm always very grateful to our sponsors, because we get to do such interesting interviews on triangulation. And I learn as much, I think, as everybody else. Maybe sometimes I learn more because I'd never heard of IARPA, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity. They're fairly new. And I'm thrilled to have its director on with us today, Dr. Jason Matheny.
So I guess by having a there's going to be program managers, right, that have great ideas that you guys haven't anticipated on how to address some major intelligence issue or you know, modeling issue or whatnot. How does IARPA balance? Do you find yourself driving or the questions that IARPA has driving the choice of program managers, or the program, are you getting a little bit of both, where program managers are coming and saying, this is what I think you guys should be doing because this would advance this technology, be wonderful for your mission?
Yeah, most of our programs are led by the program managers, introduced by the program managers. They're not ones that we put out a call for program managers to come and lead. Instead, they come with the program manager. And that's important because the program managers are going to work hardest for the idea that really is their own, and they'll be most passionate about it. On the other hand, we have to ensure that every idea is rigorously defined before we invest any money in it. So we have all the program managers answer what are called the Heilmeyer questions. And DARPA does this too. It's named after George Heilmeyer, who was a former DARPA director. And the questions, which are deceptively simple, are really, what's your idea? What's the problem you're trying to solve? How is that problem solved at present? What are the limitations of those current approaches? How is your idea different? How would you measure success? And then, you know, what are your... What are the interim goals and final goals, and how much is it going to cost? So when we come with new program managers who are tackling a new idea, they have to answer those Heilmeyer questions, typically in a fashion that's sort of like a dissertation defense. So they're in front of a group of subject matter experts from within and outside of government. Who will grill them on the technical background, grill them on assumptions that they're making, assess whether or not the technical approach is one that that's technically sound, and then we have to identify whether or not there's a transition partner, that is a partner within government that's part of national intelligence that views this as a priority. And that's important because you don't want this to just be an interesting science fair project. You want this to be a technology that will make a difference for the kinds of challenges that the intelligence community has. Because we're not the National Science Foundation, we really need to ensure that the research and the technologies remain relevant. And I think that's one where we invest a lot. We make sure that our government partners are at the table throughout the life of a program. Before we fund anything from the final dollar we spend, that transition partner is there to make sure that this is not just an academic exercise.
You're funded through the DOD. How are you funded?
We're funded through the National Intelligence Program. Okay. So that's the national intelligence budget that goes to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence.
Got it. I'm looking at the seedling page because this is also fun stuff. This is, it says there are a variety of opportunities to engage with IARPA, and a seedling is another option to receive funding for your ideas. These are shorter, 9 to 12 month research efforts designed to take an idea from disbelief to doubt. And some of these are just really, what's interesting is I would imagine, you know, at first I think a lot of this is about big data and machine learning, but some of it's just very, you know, how a meme becomes a reality, you know, or spectral holographic optical processing, or, you know, a study of smart devices. I guess all of this stuff is of great import to national policy. It's fascinating.
Right. Yeah, I think the national intelligence mission, which is really about understanding events in the world and anticipating events in the world, communicating events. All of that requires such a broad range of disciplines to be advanced. So we fund work in physics and engineering, biology, chemistry, sociology, psychology, political science. Some of the work, in fact, that we're probably best known for is in human judgment and decision making. Because when analysts make decisions about what's happening in the world, it really is coming down to a question of what kinds of biases and heuristics do human analysts use in understanding the world, and how do we improve those? So we ran the world's largest forecasting tournament that involved around 40,000 people making judgments about millions of judgments about global events, and tried to characterize what distinguishes the strong forecasters, the accurate forecasters, from those who are not quite as accurate. So doing fundamental work on cognitive psychology is something that turns out is incredibly important to national intelligence, but as are those other topics that you listed. For instance, holography is something that's important for presenting information, but there's also optical computing that allows us to leverage light to perform information processing. Memes are, you know, concepts that are sort of spread throughout society. It's really important to understand those. For example, how do we understand the spread of extremist thought in different kinds of social media? How can we understand the spread of misinformation? That's important in order to analyze how events may be affected by social media in other countries. And then we do quite a lot of work in understanding how diseases are changing over time, how diseases evolve over time, because that affects not only our own population that might be posted overseas, but also affects global health and global stability in ways that I think are, you know, dramatically illustrated in the last few years with Ebola, chikungunya, and Zika. To give one example, we co-fund a project with Microsoft Research to develop a new kind of mosquito trap that allows us to much more quickly analyze diseases that are spread by mosquito. And now that trap is being deployed by Microsoft in Florida and Texas for Zika control, but it has much broader applications to public health around the world.
Do you find there's a correlation between how a virus spreads amongst mosquitoes and perhaps, or a pathogen spreads amongst mosquitoes and a computer virus? Let's take a very high level here.
Yeah, so the analogies between sort of biology and cybersecurity are ones I think have been explored in some cases. So, there are some similarities between biology and cybersecurity. One is that both involve self-replicating threats. And that is something that is distinct from other categories of threats, such as nuclear weapons or chemical weapons. Biological organisms and computer viruses both use the machinery of a host in order to create more copies of itself. And that is something that distinguishes them and, in fact, makes them in some ways more difficult to control and more difficult to analyze. Than threats from, say, nuclear weapons or threats from chemical weapons, which don't self-replicate. I mean, that's one of the nice things that you can say about nuclear weapons. So I think that the analogies between biology and cybersecurity also do suggest some new approaches to cybersecurity. So how can you develop cyber defenses that have sort of long-term immune memory that have host responses that are adaptive in the same way that human immune system is, or other immune systems from other animals that have had millions of years to evolve in order to develop strategies to cope with disease.
I want to have a full disclosure here because I'm going to be submitting a white paper to some of the program managers here. We're looking at the convergence of mass storage and biology. I just wanted to make sure that that disclosure is there.
I love this kind of feeling of this is just very high level. You're solving fascinating problems. It's exciting. And I don't want to put you on the spot here, Director Matheny, because but I'm going to ask you something a little more personal, because I could see in your background you really come from wanting to make a difference in the world and helping people. But I think in our audience especially, there's this sense that government sometimes can use technology against its people. And some of the technologies you're developing, while obviously very useful in protecting our shores, I think might concern people that they might be used against us. And, ever since the Edward Snowden revelations, I think people are a little bit more mistrustful of our national security and intelligence agencies. When you came to this, I'm sure you dealt with this yourself.
Yeah, so thanks for asking. I mean, I think this is something that that everybody who works, not just in national security, but in, say, data science or machine learning or biology, has to wrestle with sort of not only the short-term implications of what they're doing, but also what the long-term implications are. So I gave that a lot of thought before I joined National Intelligence, and I think there were several things that made me think that the net benefits were highly positive. One is recognizing the seriousness with which IARPA takes civil liberties and privacy issues. I mean, every project that we start goes through a civil liberties and privacy review. To an extent that I think is one that could be duplicated in other science organizations to their benefit. Another is that most of our long-term issues as a society, particularly in wrestling with, say, the long-term trends in biosecurity and cybersecurity, will require better intelligence in order to solve. They really are in large part problems about what kind of information we have and when we get it in order to make decisions that can reduce risk. And that's something that I think National Intelligence really does have at the core of its mission, which is to assess risk and provide warning. Another thing that I think ethically is something that I've been deeply impressed by in national intelligence is just the extent to which the personnel, the officers, the staff within national intelligence, the gravity that they recognize in their work and its impact on others, I think even compared to something like international health, in which there's extraordinary talent, extraordinary a level of professional ethics, I'm just so deeply impressed by what I've seen and experienced in the intelligence community. So I think those are some things that put me a little bit more at ease. I do think that we are in a stage of technology development, particularly in biology, but also in computer science and even material science, in which we see lots of emerging risks on the horizon. And there are risks that that disrupt the kinds of models and institutions that we've developed in the past to deal with national security problems. These are risks that aren't limited to nation states or even to highly organized groups. I mean, if you had one technically sophisticated individual who had a PhD in virology, that person could do a huge amount of damage. I mean, with numbers of casualties that previously only nation states would have been able to have. So I think we really are in an age where this notion of a super empowered individual is one that we're going to have to confront as a global security risk for the decades to come.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you said that, Jason, it's really clear we live in a dangerous time, and it's so gratifying for me to see what IARPA is up to and to see, you just read through the stuff, the clear intelligence that's being applied to this. And, the other side of not doing it in government is it could be done in private industry behind closed doors and used to our detriment in other ways, commercially. And I think that the fact that you're doing this in, as far as possible openly and involving universities and research institutions openly is really the best way to do that. I hope you don't think I'm attacking you, but I do. I think that this is an important issue. The ethical issue is an important issue. I mean, when you do things like the Janus program, which is facial recognition in real world conditions, you know, the potential for misuse of that is high. So it's gratifying to know that the scientists and researchers at IARPA think about that as well. And I have to say, that's probably you're doing more of that than some people behind closed doors in commercial institutions might be doing.
Well, I was wondering if some of the advances in the technology are also I'm one for advancing technology. I'm absolutely, I live for it. But is advancing technology also adding to the risk? Are you seeing that, if some technologies get out, of course, the
nuclear proliferation is a really good example of that, isn't it, Mark?
Well, you know? Yeah, or the virus done right. In a small lab of, three people.
Right. I think there's some technologies that we wish we could uninvent.
Put
as a
back
society,
in the bottle,
right?
Yeah.
And we don't want to make those technologies. So we go through a risk assessment process at IARPA. Is this the sort of technology that we want to create? Is it the sort of technology that we would not have regrets about afterwards? We don't develop any weapons here, so we focus on intelligence analysis, intelligence collection, and intelligence security. So how do you collect data? How do you analyze data? And how do you protect data? That said, there are risks with those technologies as well. And I think, for instance, one of the debates that we've been involved in the last couple of years is one related to safety around AI systems, which has become an issue in the public eye as well, which is how do you ensure that the systems that are performing certain kinds of tasks autonomously, like, for instance, performing financial trades or regulating network traffic or moving power from one part of the grid to another, how do we ensure that all of those autonomous systems are doing what they ought to do and don't have vulnerabilities that would cause enormous damage? And that's something that we're deeply keen in ensuring that the systems that we use as a society that are autonomous are safe, that they're reliable, that they're verified, so that their behaviors are ones that are not surprising. You want to be able to ensure the reliability of systems before you introduce them into the wild. So we invest in a variety of research efforts that are really aimed at sort of validation and verification of analytic systems before they're put into practice. One of the things that we require, for instance, of some of our machine learning work is that they be able to explain how they reached a certain result. And part of that is a sociological need that the society of analysts who use these tools will not accept results unless they understand them and how those results were reached. But part of it also is that you are much more likely to be able to detect an error in a model if the model has to explain itself. So we've done work on that kind of explainable AI, and DARPA is also doing a great new program called Explainable AI. And then we also have been looking at the problem of how to make machine learning resistant to various kinds of spoofs or attacks. This is not something that comes up in the commercial world very often because most people aren't trying to fool Siri or Amazon Echo. Most people aren't trying to, flummox their own machine learning system. But when it comes to understanding, for instance, how you might camouflage a tank to make a tank look like a school bus from space, that's a real problem, and it's one that we in national intelligence have to get right.
Love this. Let me ask you about the National Strategic Computing Initiative. President Obama announced this last year to forward work in high-performance computing. And IARPA is one of the foundational agencies in all of this. Tell me about your work in this.
So IARPA invests in a few different forms of next-generation computing research. The one that we're probably best known for is in quantum computing, and we have a few different research programs that we've run in that area that involve multiple colleges and universities and companies around the world. Then we also invest in something that's a little less exotic, which is using superconductors to solve the energy problem that most computing suffers from. So most of the energy that our computers use is used in moving bits of information between processing and memory, and then back to processing. And the challenge there is that each of those movements of information creates heat and requires a fairly large amount of energy per action. So using superconductors, we can reduce that energy to zero in the interconnect between processing and memory. So in principle, you could have then a superconducting supercomputer that would consume less than 1/100th of the energy and physical size of a traditional computer. So that's something that we pursue. And then we also pursue a large-scale effort to reverse engineer how mammalian brains are able to process information so efficiently. So in contrast to the largest supercomputers today that consume in the tens of millions of watts of energy, a human brain consumes about 20 watts, so less than 1/1,000,000th of the amount of energy. And the human brain can still do things that that exceed the grasp of any large-scale supercomputer. So we can learn from a much smaller set of data. We can do what's sometimes called one-shot learning. We can also distinguish the varieties of categories of objects at levels that that computers still can't. We can engage in certain kinds of planning and strategy that computers can't. So we can do all that and at a tiny fraction of the amount of energy that the traditional computers take. So how is it that brains are so efficient? So we have a large-scale effort funding work in multiple universities that's aimed at measuring the circuit diagram of neural tissue, understanding what are those neural circuits that are responsible for learning in the brain so efficiently.
We will continue with our great conversation with Dr. Matheny in just a second, but it's time to take a break and talk to you about Corning and optical cables. Corning, you know, I'm sure, the kings of glass, right? I mean, I had Corningware as a kid. I don't think they make that stuff anymore. But I certainly know that most of us have Corning glasses, Gorilla Glass, on our smartphones, right? And they keep innovating there. Well, they're best known nowadays for their optical fiber cables. And now you can get Corning's optical cables in your home or office or studio. They've figured out a way, even if you don't have an optical interface, to use fiber optics. There's a really a great reason instead of traditional cables, because fiber optic cables from Corning are thinner, they're lighter, they're really robust. You know, in the past, I wouldn't have recommended fiber optic cables because you couldn't bend them or twist them or step on them. You can. These things are super tough. Of course, it's Corning, right? I'm sure they're using their Gorilla Glass technology in there in some way. But most importantly, the fiber optic cables go a long, long way. They don't have the attenuation problems that copper cables have. So with Corning's Thunderbolt cables, you can go 200 feet, 60 meters. And they, by the way, full throughput. They're really fast. No attenuation at all. With their USB 3 cables, 165 feet, 50 meters. So why would you want that? Well, it makes it easy to move noisy or space-consuming or hot devices away from your workspace. I have a great you know, I have that great Drobo drive array, but I don't want it on my desk because it's big and hot and noisy. So I put it, you know, out. Literally, it's outside my office. Actually, believe it or not, I put it in the. We have a little refrigerated wine closet, so it's cool. It's a perfect place for it, but it's not near my desk. It's about 25 feet away from my desk. So I just run a Corning cable and keep the drive array in there. It's awesome. I'm not alone, by the way. Universal Audio, you might be familiar with them. They make Thunderbolt audio interfaces, really high-end stuff. They do the same thing. They use optical cables by Corning to give their studios acoustic isolation so they could test new equipment like those best-selling Thunderbolt audio interfaces without any interference from noisy drives. This is the cool part. If you look on the website, opticalcablesbycorning.com, because what they had to do, of course, these cables use light, but your USB port, your Thunderbolt port, is not. It's, you know, it's RF or whatever. I shouldn't say it's RF. It's copper, right? So they have a little tiny dongle on each end of the cable that translates into light. It's a transceiver that makes light, receives light, and then they send the light down the fiber optic cable. I think this was the breakthrough that made these cables possible. Optical cables by Corning. They're available at all major electronics and professional AV retailers, including Apple stores, Amazon, B&H, and more. Optical cables by Corning. When you need them, you'll be glad you got them. I use them all the time now at home. Optical cables by Corning. Longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to opticalcablesbycorning.com to learn more. And, of course, we thank Corning for the great work they're doing and making it possible for us to do triangulation and have great guests like Dr. Jason Matheny. Isn't this interesting? Of IARPA.
David Brooks called you one of the most creative government agencies of all. Wired magazine. The Wire wrote about the IARPA as the obscure government agency trying to predict the future. I'm really struck by how exciting and interesting the work you're doing is. And I wish more, I mean, here we are on a technology network with a bunch of technologists, and I cover technology nonstop, and I'd never heard of you. Of course, IARPA is fairly new, only 9 years old, but I'm just, it actually makes me feel very patriotic and very happy to know that there are people in our government who are working on these hard problems that could make a massive difference in the future down the road. It's very exciting.
Thanks, Leo. I think the programs here, one of the benefits of working in advanced research and working on technologies is that we're ultimately optimists at heart.
Yeah.
The scientists and engineers, I think, go into science and engineering because they have an optimistic view of what's possible if we solved a series of problems. And although some of the work that we do is because of an assessment of something that's a rather grim possibility, like trying to reduce the likelihood of accidental nuclear war or trying to reduce the likelihood of a pandemic, I think what really motivates us is that through technology, we can dramatically improve the quality and the security on Earth for the vast majority of people alive or who will be alive. That sort of optimism that the future could be actually really quite grand is something that I think drives a lot of the research here and a lot of the research that we fund.
Right on. And it is something that I think we as a nation should take the lead in. And we've got the people, we've got the brains, as they say in the Bionic Man, we have the technology, and I think it's great that we're doing this. Mark, I'm so glad you brought Dr. Matheny and IARPA to my attention. This is
what I find
stuff.
Really, really exciting is that crossroads of some of the greatest, computer scientists together with the biologists. You know, you're talking about getting a brain to actually use 20 watts as a supercomputer. Well, why don't you make it photosynthetic, right? Make it a photosynthetic, add some chloroplast to your neurons and start getting brains.
Biocomputers.
That are light. Well, not just biocomputers, but photosynthetic biocomputers, right?
Yeah.
If you allow yourself the right to get away from what biology's mission is reproduction and so forth, and start using life as a substrate for engineering, you can really, this is the one place you could probably be allowed to do that sort of thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think the future of biology and what will be possible when we start thinking of things like that, like how do we leverage energy generation in order to achieve certain tasks that right now are performed synthetically. How can we do that biologically? I think that the excitement that we can see in the research community about taking on some of those problems in an unconventional way is something that drives a lot of our own program managers. So we're this would be an open invitation both to you, Mark, and to Leo and all of your listeners, that we really are excited in receiving the unsolicited proposals for research that we wish we had been smart enough to ask for. And our process for that is really informal. I mean, if you visit us at IARPA.gov, you can find a full list of our program managers, find the program managers whose interests, which are all listed, are closest to those that that you want to pursue, and just set up a time to talk about your idea or send them over email.
And remember that the JEDI project was just some physicist and another guy, and they were just civilians, and they said, we could do this, and won the challenge.
Exactly. Exactly. And we have some of those open challenges up all the time. We just closed one last month, and it was the same sort of case where a bunch of people working on their own were able to beat a bunch of, you know, multi-billion-dollar companies. So I think that kind of innovation that's grassroots, we love to see that.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Mathena, thank you so much for spending time with us. It sounds like you have one of the most fun jobs in the world, and I'm glad that you're doing it, because it sounds like these are things we need to do. And I'm really pleased to hear that. You know, sometimes we think of government as not very sophisticated technically, kind of a little bit 19th century in their thinking. And it's great to see how forward thinking some parts of government can be. I'm really pleased to have you on the show today. Thank you.
Thanks, Leo and Mark. It's been a pleasure.
It's great.
Thank you.
Jason Mathena, he is the director of IARPA, which is part of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. And if you know about DARPA, IARPA is like DARPA on steroids. It's pretty exciting. The Intelligence Advanced Research Project Activity. Why activity and not agency? That's interesting.
I think that was up to Congress.
Okay, enough said.
Yeah, we're happy to be an activity. We are, in fact, active.
There may be some reason that you call it activity and not agency, like you're not an agent. I don't know. There's probably some deep meaning to all of this. Thank you, Dr. Mathena. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you.
And Mark, thank you once again. You've always brought us some of the most interesting guests. What fun that was.
Thank you, Leo. Yeah. I appreciate the opportunity, because right now we just looked at the, you know, through a peephole and saw a little bit of what the world is on the in the mission of what IARPA is doing. And
definitely go to the website. I mean, you look at the seedlings, at the programs they're working on, you know, I just even going to about and looking at the year in review to see the things IARPA has been doing just this year alone, you'll get a sense of the broad range and sweep of their research. And it's all stuff we get fascinated by, right?
Right. And they're approachable. If you go to their IARPA website, go to the research programs, program managers, names, you can click on them and access an email. And then if you have an idea, keep it under 100 words. Keep it very, very short, very, very precise. We've done this. We've met with program managers, and they are very, very accessible.
What's the project that you want to do work on?
Well, I co-founded a company that's making a hard drive that is biological. It's half.
Oh, wow.
It's silicone-based chip with a biological DNA component to store the information. And we're looking at petabytes per centimeter squared at the end of our roadmap. But you can imagine a laptop computer with 100,000 terabytes. This is very, very doable. A lot of hard work, but definitely doable.
But this is exactly the kind of high-risk, high-reward stuff that IARPA focuses on, right?
You look at quantum computing, right? How much data is that going to generate? And is there a technology today that can handle mass storage?
Right.
And you look at DNA, it's stored. We sequenced the genome of a horse that's 700,000 years old. You can take a Neanderthal bone, right? He dies in a cave in southern France 10,000 years later. You go grab that bone, grind it up, you sequence the information, you've got his genome. You've got that 3.5 gigs of information from his mother and from his father. Or if you look at the human body, right? We have 10 trillion cells, each carrying 6 gigabytes. So you have 60 trillion gigabytes worth of data sitting right in you, Leo. 60 trillion gigabytes. Imagine a tree, a big oak tree, how much data is stored in that oak tree. Then we've been storing information for 3.8 billion years using DNA. So it's exquisitely stable. It will last virtually forever. At least you have to pop it off the chip and so forth, because you want it just in a little glass tube, and then you can put it on the moon, and then aliens 10 million years from now will be able to know everything about us.
I want to mention the Jedi mind thing because it's really fascinating. This was, remember, the attempt to figure out if you could see if somebody was trustworthy. And it was solved by kind of, not amateurs, but Troy Lau, who's a PhD physicist with his background in data mining and finance, and Scott Kuzdeba, who is a research engineer in statistical learning. And they came up with the best way of figuring out if somebody's trustworthy based on their heart rate. I think it was their heart rate. Let me see here. It's in the press release. Someone's heart rate and reaction time were the most useful signals for predicting how likely that person was to keep a promise. And it's just, I mean, that can come from, it could come from anybody, right?
I have to go back and listen to this show because there's a lot of content in there that, right overhead. And one of them, I mentioned, he won a point. He was talking about a test where they put 40,000 people together to try to find out which people were able to predict things better.
They're working on, can we use ESP. Crowds? Well, it was, can we use crowdsourcing to do a better job than analysts, trained analysts do? You know, the wisdom of crowds. And these are the kinds of things that they're very blue sky. But if one of them turns out to be useful, it could change everything. So I just love
this. So close to ESP.
I know. Right? Well, it is kind of.
You know, network ESP.
Yeah, kind of is. Crowdsourcing is very interesting. Anyway, IARPA.org if you want to read more. It is the kind of the most unknown and yet most interesting government agency out there, I have to say. It's
you
fascinating.
You heard it first here on Twit.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Mark Pelletier. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for joining us. We do triangulation, and it's always interesting. I've looked at the list of people coming up. There's some great conversations ahead. You don't want to miss an episode. We're on every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 2100 UTC. If you want to watch live and join us in the chat room, because the chat room is really helpful, you know, in the feedback and the questions, I get a sense of what you're interested in. If you want to do that, please be here live. If you can't, though, don't worry, because we make on-demand audio and video from all of our shows available at twit.tv. In the case of this show, it's twit.tv/TRI. And of course, you know, we're everywhere you can download shows from the internet. Every, you know, Stitcher and Slacker and Google and every podcast app, Apple's podcast, Overcast, all of those. So make sure you subscribe. That way you won't miss an episode. We even have people listening to us right now on airplanes. So thank you for joining us if you're listening on an airplane. And I hope you'll come back and listen for more, because it's always a great conversation on triangulation. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time.